You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 26th of April 2018 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. On today's show...
The US mainland is within the range of our nuclear strike, and the nuclear button is put on the desk in my office at all times. They should clearly understand that this is never a threat, but a reality.
Just 4 months ago, Kim Jong-un was threatening America with nuclear war. Now he's meeting South Korea at the negotiating table. My guests today, Mary Dzhevsky and Robert Fox, will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including everyone digs deep at the Syria donor conference, apart from America. And on Monday, after weeks of protests, Armenian Prime Minister Serge Sargsyan resigned. Protests resumed after talks broke down on Tuesday, but now it looks like the country's heading towards a resolution. All that, plus a ban for tourists on one of the Philippines' most idyllic islands. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. A warm welcome indeed to Midori House. My guests today are Mary Dzhevsky, a columnist at The Guardian and Observer newspapers, and Robert Fox, defence editor of London's Evening Standard. Welcome both to the programme. Great to have you with us. At the risk of starting the programme with an understatement, things have not been harmonious with North Korea since Donald Trump took office, with angry rhetoric flying and nukes sometimes threatening to. Recent months, however, have seen a cooling off. Following an unprecedented appearance at the South Korea Winter Olympics in February, the North will be attending a summit with its southern rival on Friday. Kim Jong-un is due to meet President Moon Jae-in to discuss the denuclearization of the peninsula. Some hope that the meeting will provide an opportunity to formally end the Korean War, which has been on hiatus since the 50s. Robert Fox, let me start with you. How productive is this meeting likely to be, or how productive should we hope that it might be?
A lot of it will be done by semaphore, I think. That expectations have been raised, then lowered, and then they're all over the place, like President Trump himself. And really, this has been rehearsed as the curtain raiser for the meeting between Kim Jong-un and Trump. I think that's a mistake. I think this is very interesting and quite important in its own right. But don't expect it to yield too much. I suspect some nice words and one or two gestures will be made over disarmament, though there won't be complete nuclear disarmament, but there will be a standing down of forces. And the thing that everybody's expecting, but expectations are far too high, is of some kind of peace treaty ending the war that ended up only in an armistice in 1953. And perhaps later we should dig deeper as to why, particularly the Kim dynasty in the North really can't do that so easily.
Mary, you're sort of nodding in agreement with that. There is an understandable, I guess, almost sort of fixation on the nuclear question, nuclear proliferation, nuclear missiles specifically. But North Korea poses a broader threat anyway, even without those specifics. Is there a risk that the sort of the detail of the weaponry maybe blinds us to some of these broader questions?
I mean, I think that's partly true. And it's partly Trump's fault, too, that there's been so much emphasis on the nuclear question and the sort of niceties of weapons and all that. Whereas it is, it's an enormous geopolitical question. And the North-South Korea issue has been a destabilizing factor in the whole of the region, really, ever since you mentioned the armistice. And one of the things I think is quite interesting in the run-up to these talks is that alongside the nuclear and the weapons issue, there is the question of reunification. And in the past, there's been a sort of reunification has been sort of there. And I don't think, both because of the mood in the South, demographics in the South, and because of the mood in the North, I don't think reunification is really on the cards, certainly not at the moment. But what I do think is on the cards is exactly what Robert was talking about, which is a peace treaty. Because the absence of a peace treaty is, as it were, the genesis of all the destabilisation of everything that is there. And if only there could be a proper peace treaty, and Robert will probably explain why, why there can't be, but I think one of North Korea's problems, which is sort of encapsulated in this sort of huge insecurity of Kim Jong-un, when, especially when he first took over, is that they don't feel like, as it were, they don't feel they're being treated like a proper paid-up country. And I think one of the secrets almost to the calming down recently has been that Trump sort of took them on their own terms and had almost direct talks over the Twitter sphere, which is something that Kim Jong-un had been going on about for you, pretty much ever since he came to power.
Well, certainly in diplomatic terms, one of the less likely meeting of minds, perhaps, with Trump and Kim. Robert, to that point, actually, though, that Mary raised specifically about the peace agreement or lack of, what is your take on that? I mean, is that a pipe dream?
There's a very strong argument which says why you can't have it. There is, as Mary pointed out, the tremendous imbalance between North and South. And I don't want to be smart, but, you know, it's not only 1953, it's pre-1953 how this whole thing began after with the withdrawal of the Japanese or the defeat in 1945. One half goes under the aegis of the Soviet Union, communist, the other into the Western sphere. Now, since then, and the war started because Kim Il-sung, the grandfather, said, no, it is ours. It is going to be the glorious People's Revolution. It's going to take the whole of the Korean Peninsula for peace and humanity. Bear that in mind, because that sticks. It's the reason for the Kim dynasty being in politics and public life. And it's going to be very, very difficult. And remember, face means so much. Mm. But the imbalance is absolutely staggering. It's roughly half the population, possibly, I think, just under North to South. The GDP, I was looking it up today, is 2.1 trillion for the South and a mere 40 billion for the North. And then you go through the whole thing. Earnings per capita is about the third highest in the world in South Korea. Would you believe it? Sorry, I won't bang on about this. But for the Kim dynasty, it is really, really important because the whole raison d'être of the Republic of the North is to embrace all the Korean peninsula, peoples of all the Korean homeland, the peninsula. And that's going to be very, very hard to swallow. What this plays against is the notorious attention deficit syndrome of President Trump. But I think by now, Pompeo, the new Secretary of State, because he's been there, will have discussed this, because the South don't like this at all, but very progressive. And there's always been this slight peace movement that's come and gone in the South. And been two previous meetings, but they got absolutely nowhere. But conditions are desperate because it now turns out that one of the three main nuclear sites has collapsed under its own test. There have been even official mutterings, would you believe it, from the North, that the whole darn thing of these nukes and the arsenal have cost far too much. I mean, you're keeping over 1 million people under arms. That's a 20th of the population, with another 8 million on reserve duty. And I think things are going pretty bad, and things have gone better in the past, and they'll want cooperative. There'll be more, I think, unification of families, which has happened in the past. And I think there will be more JVs. There will be joint industrial sites somewhere close to the demilitarized zone, probably, as they had before, joint holiday resorts. But it's as long as Trump, with that notorious Twitter thumb, doesn't say, spout something silly, I don't think he will, curiously, because I think he's got a lot of other big, difficult things on his plate, namely Iran, not only the nuclear deal, but actually the playout from Syria, which is far from done and dusted, despite what you may be hearing from certain correspondents of the BBC.
Well, indeed, and we'll come to those in just a second. But I just wonder, in terms of some of the other stakeholders, Mary, and this again is going to be a theme for all the topics that we mentioned tonight, you do need to take this sort of holistic view. Mm. What of the US, I guess, without Trump and the view from Capitol Hill towards these talks on the Korean Peninsula? And what about China as well? Because there's like several elephants in that particular room. What are those other two key stakeholders? What will they be looking for?
I think that there's probably a lot of scepticism in the United States, partly because of some past performance on this, but also because of the scepticism toward Trump. So, you know, they never liked really the idea that Trump could actually succeed at Korean negotiation somehow, even by mistake. There's a lot of people that don't want that to happen. So I think there's going to be quite a degree of sort of hands-off scepticism about what could happen. China, it's very interesting because Kim Jong-un made this sort of semi-clandestine trip to China at the end of last month. And it was sort of said that he was there, and then it was not said that he was there. And then when he got back on his train, there was a sort of readout that said he'd been, and both sides said that he'd been. And there is a view that says that China isn't really very happy either about Kim Jong-un or about the diplomacy and feels that maybe they're being upstaged by the Americans. Whereas I think there is an argument for seeing it the other way around and saying that Trump at one point sort of issued an ultimatum to the Chinese saying, you know, this is your problem, not our problem. You get on with your ally and tell them what, lay it on the line. So I think that that's one thing. I'd also mention a third country, which I think is also very interesting, which is Japan.
Yes.
Because it was Shinzo Abe has made, he was, I think, the first foreign leader to go and meet Trump. And he went on his own initiative and he went to Trump Tower before the inauguration. I mean, in terms of protocol, it was very iffy. And he's been quite a regular visitor since. And he was there this past weekend. He went to see Trump at Mar-a-Lago and I think they played golf. But I think one of the countries most worried about any sort of developments in Korea, which they would see as potentially upsetting a sort of balance that they've got used to, that's Japan. And so I'm sure that would have been the subject of what they were talking about in Florida last weekend.
Well, indeed. Let's move on to a conference which took place in Brussels earlier this week. International donors failed to reach a $9 billion target to help people trapped in Syria. Much of the shortfall, one could argue, is courtesy of the United States, which declined to commit to a donation while it continues to review its Syria policy. Now, while Trump and Macron have been rather hogging the headlines in Washington, D.C., it hasn't been the only meeting taking place. U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton has met with Israeli Defense Minister Avigdor Lieberman to discuss what to do about Iran's ever bolder manoeuvres in the Middle East. Mary Dejewski, just on the underfunding, first of all, what's your reaction to that? I guess that was sort of broadly telegraphed, wasn't it, even in the build-up?
Yes, I mean, I think it was. I was slightly surprised that the meeting was going to happen and that it was given such flagging as though it could reach, it had half a chance of raising more money. But I do think it's been one of the issues between, as it were, East and West, which have been so polarised on the whole of the Syria question. And at various points, the Russians have turned around and said, well, it would be awfully nice if you guys out there helped with the rebuilding and the reconstruction work. And until very recently, there was zero response on that. The attitude, to my mind, was quite unreasonably political because the Europeans, I mean, it wasn't just the Americans, it was most of the Europeans as well, who were saying, well, you know, Russia, you've put yourselves in charge of this. You should jolly well be doing, you should be carrying the bulk of this work. Why are you asking us? But I sort of sensed that after the questionable chemical weapons episode, the latest one, that almost marked a little sort of break for Western policy, and it almost covered up a slight turn, at least in European view, which I think we saw in a way at the Brussels conference, where there was a degree. Okay, you say, well, there's a shortfall, and that shortfall mostly is because of the Americans, but it's no longer because of the Europeans. Mm. So I think that there may, we may be looking at some shift there.
Robert, what have you made of what's been said or not said? Stefan de Mistura, the UN Special Envoy for Syria, has also been commenting on this. Do you sort of share that reading of Mary's when we look at this conference and its, I guess, rather predictable failure to reach its target, at least?
Stefan de Mistura is an old friend, and he's the eternal optimist. I do hope somebody finds a little bit of money in the Nobel Peace Prize to give it to him.
I think he deserves a gigantic medal.
Because he's a real sticker. He's better in that respect. He's perhaps not, in Mensa terms, up to Javier Solana and Lakhdar Brahimi, but Lakhdar Brahimi particularly. But boy, he sticks it through in the way that those other two don't. He has been fascinating, as he can be, this morning, because he said it's the back channels that are really being worked. And Mary is absolutely right. Sorry, that's very patronising. I don't mean that. Came
Thank
out
you.
Wrong. But Mary is right. What did they get themselves into with the strike? Prima facie, yes, they said that. Well, then apparently what it was Macron's team and May's team said, look, we may not have a resolution, but there is convention which conforms to law here. And that's why they argued proportionality. And they had to wind up the Americans, but they started talking to the Russians, saying, look, here, we're going to do it. Get your folk out of the way. And they got the Iranians out of the way, because we do not want a war over this. We do, least of all, do we want a war. We're not aiming for regime change, and we're not aiming for war with the Iranians. Now, Stefan was saying this morning that behind that, what they're talking to the Russians about, can they join the two wings? Because there are two lots of talks. There's the Geneva talks and there's the Astana talks. The Astana talks actually comes up with jolly good ideas. But there are only three principal powers, Russia, Iran, obviously Syria, but very much in Russia's pocket. And I don't mean that in a snide way. It just has to be. And Turkey. But they've revived and come up with some real ideas about a constitutional negotiation. Because I think whoever is looking at it must be one of the real, you probably know, old hands that really knows the Middle East in the Kremlin, saying, look, oops, yes, everybody's saying we want a unitary state again out of Syria. Mm-hmm. Chance would be a fine thing. And above all, the Turks and the Iranians would know that. So they're talking about a constitutional arrangement. What was fascinating from Stefan's point of view, old diplomat, and he was saying, look, I'm not ashamed. It's my job. It's high diplomacy that's required now, because the thing that I'm most worried about, it's not egregious attacks by the Assad regime and the Idlib enclave, but it's Iran. Mm. And it's Iran and Israel. And that's why your point about the Avigdor Lieberman visit to Bolton, oops, because Haaretz is quoting Lieberman saying, as he left, this is a warning to Tehran, if Iran is going to attack us, and if they attack Tel Aviv, which is technically possible now, we will bomb Tehran. But if they attack, this is the other thing, which is much more likely to happen, Israeli territory, we are going to bomb every Iranian site in Syria. So there is real worry about it. And this now is becoming more urgent than the JCPOA, the renegotiation, or whether Trump will go for supporting the nuclear deal with Iran. And the jury's out on that.
I think I'd just like to add one thing about the, these two sets of talks that have been going on in parallel, Astana and Geneva or Vienna. They sort of migrate around. But one of the things I thought was extremely interesting out of Macron's address to Congress yesterday. He spoke about, very briefly, about the future of Syria. And he talked about keeping Syria as a single unitary state. And I listened to that. And that seemed to me a term deliberately chosen to almost to bridge the gap between those two sets of talks, because the idea of keeping Syria together as a stable unitary state, that is the thing that the Russians have been on about since the very beginning. Mm. That is more important to them than preserving Assad. They see Assad as the tool for keeping Syria together. And it seemed to me that Macron's speeches are always very, very careful. And it just seemed to me that he was sending a particular signal with that.
Oh, and Mary, just to the point, which
part of a French legacy too, of course, very much, and it must be.
Absolutely,
indeed.
Yes.
And to that point that Robert sort of alluded to about the United States visit Israel and the Lieberman visit, do you think that this backdrop and all of these complexities in some way could enable the United States to reaffirm their backing more broadly for Israel, for Lieberman, in a way the country might have been reluctant to do before? Mm.
I think that's very, I mean, I find that very hard to judge at the moment, because Israel is certainly very, very preoccupied with the idea, or as they see it, the reality that Iran is a big winner from what's been going on in Syria, that it's going to have bases
Russia,
there, that
actually.
it's going to have a presence there. And it also seems to me that Israel is not convinced that Russia can actually keep Iran in check. It seems sort of slightly puzzled about the power relationships there, and it doesn't trust it thinks that Iran will not be kept in check by Russia, whether Russia wants to or not, that it actually won't be able to, and I think some of the Israeli action we've seen that's either been claimed or not claimed has actually been directed against Iran. It's not been directed at anything to do with chemical weapons. It's been directed against what are seen as Iranian interests. Yeah. And I think that, you know, when we hear Trump talking about Iran, you know, then... But also with Macron yesterday, and he was talking about, well, you know, maybe we should... Maybe Trump could be persuaded not to talk down the Iran deal, not to leave the Iran deal, but maybe we should augment it altogether. But I mean, I agree with Robert. I think that in some ways that's been overtaken, because we're not talking about Iran within Iranian borders anymore. We're talking about Iran projecting itself towards into Syria and then towards, as Israel would see, towards Lebanon.
Very quickly, yes, Iran is absolutely crucial to Assad and above all Russia, because it provides boots, manpower, Hezbollah, not only the bits and pieces of the Revolutionary Guard, but it is actually the Shiite levies, which cover a multitude of sins, if I can put it like that. They're quite big, 50, 60,000, absolutely vital. Your question, Tom, maximum you're going to get from America is minimalist support for Israel. We've had maximalists up to this, Tony Blair, George W. Bush, and so on. They are pulling away from that. And that is what Macron is saying. And he is saying very subtly in his speeches and in his pronouncements, Europe is going to have to do it. He knows that actually, for the kinds of things that he thinks Europe has got to take an interest in, Merkel's Germany, or Germany's Germany, isn't going to turn up to the party. And that's why he wants the Brits in there. And he is furious about their total obsession, their inability to talk or think anything outside Brexit, because he really wants them.
Well, I feel his pain on that point, Robert, I'll be honest. Yeah. Let's alight briefly in Armenia. On Monday, Armenian PM Serge Sargsyan resigned after almost a fortnight of protests led by opposition politician Nikol Pashinyan. Talks between Pashinyan's opposition and Sargsyan's Republic Party broke down. Demonstrators returned to the streets on Tuesday. Demonstrations remained largely peaceful. Now it's been announced that an election will be held on the 1st of May. Many expect Pashinyan to win, perhaps. Mary Dejewski, this seems to be going relatively sort of smoothly. The demonstrations haven't turned super ugly. Was a peaceful conclusion of sorts always inevitable here?
On the one hand, it wasn't, because these situations are so perilous at almost every stage, and it's still not over. And you know, it's just so interesting how elections have become. You know, everybody calls for elections, but actually, the danger after an election that people either disagree with or has, you know, we've seen that in so many places, that it is a very perilous time. But it also has to be said that, you know, Armenia has. Even as a post-Soviet state, and post-Soviet states tend to have quite weak systems of government, weak ideas of statehood, Armenia in some respects is an exception, because Armenia has a very strong sense of its identity, and it has a very educated population. It has a very strong and generally wealthy diaspora, all over the world, but especially in the United States and in France. And for all those reasons, there are sort of stabilizing factors that set it apart from other places where it's been more difficult to have those sort of transitions.
Well, Robert, to a question we perhaps could have asked at any point during the programme so far, where is Russia in all of this? Because Armenia is an interesting case.
Absolutely right. They have Mary's painted that post-Soviet picture. And it looks like a recipe, doesn't it? But it isn't. And it isn't for the very reason, I think, that Mary has mentioned. This is such an Armenian story. I have quite a few Armenian friends, and they are a very interesting culture, deep. One of the oldest churches, one of the oldest, if not the oldest church in Christianity, and so on. That's why the Russians don't mess. And I think Putin is far too shrewd. They've got a base there. He knows the power of the Armenian diaspora, you know, going through the genocides or not and the denials of the Ottoman Turks from the First World War, which they've just been commemorating the centenary of, not very good grammar, but they've just been doing it. That they are there, they are very prominent, they're wonderful go-betweens. It is like the Jewish diaspora. They punch intellectually so much above their weight. And actually the Russians do realise that. And actually I don't see some weird twist of the irredentist plot and tanks rolling or whatever. That isn't what it's about. It's a vicious war of words, and it's a tale of everyday Central Asian corruption too.
Let's just move on finally at the end of the programme to the Philippines very briefly. Rodrigo Duterte has ordered that the idyllic island of Boracay close to tourists. The island last year attracted some 2 million visitors, doesn't have the infrastructure to cope with those extra bodies. The sewage system has been so badly hit. Duterte branded Boracay a cesspit. Classic Duterte rhetoric. Visitors will be barred for 6 months so they can clean up. Mary Dajewski, good idea, bad idea? Has Duterte done something positive? Is that even possible?
Well, if it lasts just for 6 months, then he probably has done something positive. The problem, of course, is that if it's closed for longer, or if it's closed sort of forever, then nobody can see these glorious places. And there is this gigantic problem of mass tourism. I mean, you know, I curse every French half term in London, because you can hardly get around, and everything is just so crowded in central London. And you say, with, you know, the English Tourist Board, please go somewhere else. Please go to Shakespeare Country. Please go to Stonehenge. Please, but everywhere is so crowded.
Robert, here's one for you, just briefly, if you can. If you were given the power, the dream you've long had, you're in charge, where would you close to tourists? You spend a lot of time at some wonderful classic sites of antiquity, Italy, for example. Where, if you could just say, right,
there are three in Italy. It is a major crisis now in the summer in Venice, as it is in the bit of Venice on the other side of the Adriatic, Dubrovnik. I mean, real, real problems. But I was shocked, horrified, just a year or so ago, going to Agrigento, where I wouldn't say as a boy, but as a young student. And you could wander lonely as a cloud. You met a shepherd, had a bit of he smoked something very interesting with him, and there was nobody else in sight. There were 10,000 tourists going through these temples south of Agrigento.
I'd just add a footnote. I've just spent 2 weeks in Mexico looking at ancient sites across southern Mexico, and the place is empty. The roads are empty, the sites are empty, so everybody can go to Mexico.
Like the Valley of the Kings and the Queens.
Waiting for the Philippines to reopen, everybody go to Mexico.
There you go. Beat a path to two places. One, to where Mary's talking about in Mexico, and secondly, surely to meet Robert's shepherd friend.
He's probably dead now from that smoking.
if you're feeling brave, head that way. There we must and should indeed leave it. Mary Dejewski and Robert Fox, thanks for joining us on Midori House. The show is produced by Augustin Macellari, research by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Pierre-Antoine Denis, and our studio manager was Christy Evans. My thanks to them all. Andrew has the Urbanist for you at 1900, and Andrew Muller has the Monocle Daily at 2200. Do be sure to stay tuned for that. This show's back at the same time tomorrow, 1800 here in London, but that's all for the Thursday edition. Thank you very much for listening. My name is Tom Edwards. Goodbye.